Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners, tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, my guest today, talking to me from cold morning in Alice Springs, live on the telephone, is Tricia Morton-Thomas. Tricia, welcome to the program. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm very good, Tiger. It's nice to be here. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you on here. And I should mention in the intro that Tricia Morton-Thomas is a very well-known First Nations woman, female actress, First Nations actress, director, and there may be a few other things I failed to uncover, but yes, you've been involved in the industry for some years, Tricia.
Yeah, I've been in film and television, I think, near on 20 years now.
Wow.
Before that, I was in radio. So.
Okay, well, let's go into that in a little while. First up, tell us your mob, your country.
My country is in Mudgera. It's about 250 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs. But, you know, I mostly live in Alice now. I sort of grew up out on my country and in Alice and yeah, sort of just floating up and down that way.
All right. You went to school and stuff in Alice Springs?
Yeah, I went to school here. Mm. Old Traeger Park Primary School, where all the little poor ones went. All the mongrels went there, apparently.
All the hard-head fellas, eh?
Yes, all the hard-head. Lovely people, but just, you know, refused to lay down and take everything.
That's carrying the spirit of our ancestors with us, that is. That's a good trait.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, yes, that's a good trait. You mentioned radio. You started out in radio before you went into acting?
Yeah, I started out at Karma. I worked there for a good number of years. I started when I was about 14 or something like that.
Behind the mic? On the microphone?
Yeah, behind the microphone. And from Karma I went to the ABC and then sort of left the ABC because I didn't like their morals at that time.
Hmm.
Oh, well, the morals of my editor. And then went off to Sydney and worked with Bangarra for a while and then went into acting.
All right. So that came about in Sydney, the acting bug or the opportunity for acting?
Yes, it did. I went to the Eora College one day just to sort of have a look at it and thought, well, you know, I could go here and sign myself up for a drama course, and now here I am 20 years later.
Good one, eh? Yeah. But I'm sure there was a bit of an acting bug in. If you talk to friends and family of yours, they'll tell you, I can imagine, as with most of us black fellas, whether we're making it big time and call ourselves directors and make it into movies and things or not, we're generally told by our family, this one was always acting and pretending to have a microphone or singing and acting the goat.
I think, with the microphone and the mop on the head, you know, the little wig on, that was my brother, and I was dragged up on the stage. I don't know how I got into acting, to be honest. I think I was extremely shy as a kid, as a teenager anyway.
Mm.
Just wouldn't look people in the eye, always looking at the ground, barely ever said boo. So I honestly don't know how I ended up here.
All right. But looking back over it, I mean, you were in Radiant. I mean, what a brilliant movie that was. That was just amazing for its time and stuff. I mean, and that was a number of years ago. You played a lead role in Radiant.
Yeah, I did. I played old May, old crusty May. It just can drive like hell. But, yeah, that was straight out of drama school. Rachel Perkins had come along to my final year performance and sort of walked away from there with the idea to make a short film on Radiant. But Louis Nauro sort of basically told her, I won't give it to you unless you make a feature film. And so that's sort of how the ball got rolling, I guess. And I ended up playing May, which was originally given to Rena Owen, you know, from Once Was Warrior. Once Were Warriors.
Yes.
Yeah, she was playing Cressy originally, but something happened in that, somewhere in that mix-up, and then I got a call back from them to ask them to come back in and play May because they had now recast Rachel Mazza as Cressy.
All right. What was it like on the set, making the film and stuff? I mean, it was an amazing movie.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, it was very much fun. It was a lot of, I think, I was very proud of working with Rachel and Warwick Thornton, who was the DOP at the time.
Another Alice Springs man.
Yeah.
And well, what's DOP? Director of Photography
Director
or something?
Director of Photography, yeah.
All right, yeah.
So there was me, Rachel and Warwick, who'd all gone through Karma together, and now we were all making a movie together, and it was really exciting. It's still, it's in my heart, it's probably one of my favourite films.
It'd have to be. So what other films have you been involved in?
I've been making films more than being in front of the film.
Okay.
So I've done a lot of documentaries through Karma, the Nanapa Nanaka series, where I directed or I produced or, you know, production managed. And then other films, it's mostly Redburn now, and then just now 8MMM. And like, a lot of people say, oh, well, you haven't done much. It's like, well, I didn't come across any scripts that I actually wanted to do. I was offered a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, it was written, a lot of scripts were written by non-Aboriginal people around, you know, around 20 years ago. The Indigenous film industry and writers and directors were, we were only just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, you know, I was given a lot of scripts that had your stereotypical Aboriginal person, and I just didn't want to get involved with that at all. I decided very early on that I wouldn't take a job just for the money or for the big name in it.
Good one. Yeah. And having experience in front of the camera and then having the opportunity to direct and produce, there's got to be some benefits in that, knowing both sides of the camera?
There is. There's a lot of benefits in it, because especially in knowing how to work with actors and knowing how to get the best out of them. In 8MMM, I didn't actually direct that. I'm more a documentary director, and even then, I think I'm just scratching it in there. But as a producer, yeah, I think it's really important that you have a good idea of how actors work and how their minds work, because I think actors are very underutilized in the filmmaking process. People generally just expect you to get on, and they think your biggest skill is memory, when it's actually not. You've got a whole lot of skills to bring to the table, and you're just as highly qualified, most people, as, you know, as the cinematographer or as the sound person. Or, you know, you've got a lot of skills to bring to the table. People generally don't bring it, don't allow you to bring it.
Yes. All right. What are you working on now? Well, I'll ask you that question down a little bit later. Now we want to talk about 8MMM. 8MMM, tell us the story. It's about to start screening on ABC. What is it, tomorrow night?
Yeah,
Thursday
tomorrow night.
One night?
Wednesday night, 9:30.
Okay.
Yes.
And is it a half hour, is a series of, is it a number of programs or a series?
Yeah, it's a six-part series.
Yep.
Six-part half-hour series.
Mm-hmm. And what's your role in that?
I'm one of the creators of it. I wrote three of the episodes. I act in it, and I've produced it.
Wow, okay. You're right. We're very involved in it. So, and you wrote this. Where did you get the inspiration for this? Where did you get the ideas for 8MMM? What is it?
About me and the other three creators, we were just sitting around one of our backyards about 4 years ago, having a laugh about working in Aboriginal organisation and the culture clashes that come there when you're dealing with people like the 3Ms, who are, you know, the missionaries, the mercenaries and the misfits. And ABC then put a call out for what they call a Sacred Cows initiative, and they were looking for politically incorrect comedy. And so we went, you know, this would actually make a good comedy series. So we drew up a proposal, sent it in to the ABC, and the next thing you know, they come back to us saying, look, we're really interested in making this show. So we were over the moon, and then, you know, not realising it was going to be a four-year process and it was going to completely swallow our lives in that time.
Mm.
So, you know, I feel like I've aged about 100 years. But, But, you know, it's been a good process, I think. It's a very good learning curve.
Good one. That's one of the things with this medium, film. It takes so long. Radio, here we are, we're doing it, you know. And we, with film, it, like you say, it took 4 years for this one.
Yeah, it took 4 years. Hopefully the next one won't take as long. I think the issue with this one was we were relatively new to comedy. Well, we were absolutely green to comedy. So we came into this process where it's like, yes, we're going to get it done and we'll be on air next year. And you know, as it turned out, it was just still 4 years later and we're only just finishing it off now. Mm-hmm. It'll go to air tomorrow night and hopefully, you know, I can breathe again after that.
So tomorrow night, ABC, what time can people see it?
9:30.
9:30 on ABC. All right. Now, what's the storyline? Like, what is it? It's about a radio station, eh? A gammon radio station or what?
Yeah, it's based on a fictional radio station. Mm. There's some people saying, oh, it must be about karma. And I keep saying to them, look, I don't think karma wants to be associated with a... You know, with this radio station, because it's completely dysfunctional. So <that's> like...
As community radio...
It's quite well.
Yeah, as community radio is. Community radio, I mean, especially back in the day, and even still today to some extent, with a lot of in mainstream white fella community radio and black fella community radio, it's still a little bit like that.
Yeah, well, when I, you know, the day I started working with Karma, Robert Thornton, who was... He was a radio announcer there. He said, come on, sis, I'll show you how to use this desk. So I sort of walk in with him and sit down. I'm thinking real good way he's going to be there the whole time. And he just goes, you know, this is the microphone and fade that up and this is the turntable and you do this and do this and do this. And I was like, okay. And he said, come here, get me on the desk. So I got there and he was like, right, I'm going down to town for a few minutes. You take care of it. And I was just on the end, it's clunk, clunk. Yeah, I was just going mad in there and there was so much noise. There was hardly any music and hardly any talking, but there was a lot of clunking. But I learned very fast how to use it.
I'm glad you told that story because I've got a couple of staff here who learnt exactly the same way with their trainer. And their trainer happened to be me.
It wasn't Robert Thornton.
No, it was Buddy Tiger Bales. Their trainer was me.
I didn't drop it at all.
So I'm glad you told that story because it sort of, yeah, it shows that, well, this was the way it was that us black fellas did things back in them days, even though it might have been a good way, the best way to do it. I'm glad you told that story. Thank you.
Yeah, you learned very fast doing it that way, so there's no mucking around.
None at all, none at all, yeah. So it's generally, what is it, following the life of the station, is it? Like, the day-to-day happenings of the radio station, the people involved?
Yeah, it's you know, the AMMM to me is a celebration of these kind of organisations that just, you know, they're very lowly funded and then they're usually only funded on an annual basis, which means that you sort of, you can only prepare so far. You can't do a lot when you're being, you know, funded on a yearly basis because you just never know if you're going to be there in the next year. So it's a celebration of these organisations that run on the smell of an oily rag, but still somehow, against all odds, manage to continue functioning. You know, and I really love that about our organisations. Yeah. It'd be lovely if they were, you know, well funded as well.
But exactly.
The fact that they're not well-funded makes people very creative in the way that they keep the organisation running.
And so,
you know, the 3Ms who come from AMMM, or, you know, I heard you saying that it's one of Gary's terms as well, AMMM.
Foley's a good one with, yes, the missionaries, mercenaries and misfits. We've got three kind of people out there. Balesy, he reckons? The mercenaries, misfits and... missionaries, mercenaries and misfits, he says, you know, and I thought, well, that's a great term, Foley.
Yeah, well, it is a great term.
So he's borrowed it from you, Mob, eh? He's borrowed it from you, Mob. It's been around with you, Mob, for a long time now.
I honestly couldn't say. Maybe somebody's, you know, had a yarn with Foley and came to Alice and sort of started spreading it around a few years back. It's been in Alice for as long as I can remember where people are talking about the missionaries, mercenaries and misfits, you know. You got the missionaries who come down and they... all want to work. They want to work in Aboriginal organisations so they can advance Aboriginal people, and they want people, you know, Aboriginal people to be there. It's all good stuff that they want, except
good intentions.
They don't understand. Yeah, good intentions, but they don't understand our culture very well, and they don't understand the way we work. And so, oftentimes, their good intentions can cause a lot of trouble. And so, you know, we've got a character who's played by Ian Meadows from Moody Christmas, and he plays Jake, the missionary. And then we have the mercenary types who come to Alice Springs, and they, or you know, anywhere in Australia, and they're looking for that Aboriginal organisation to put on their resume. So once they leave the job, they then become the experts in Aboriginal culture, and you know, go on the talk circuits, and they've flown all over the world, and they speak on our behalf. And generally, these people don't like us, so they're speaking on our behalf, and they don't like us very much at all. You know, they're the kinds who'll come out with, oh, you know, 60,000 years and they've done nothing with the plate.
Yeah.
You know, and then we have the little misfits who, you know, I've got a lot of little misfits in my family, and I'm sure little, you know, all around the country there's misfits in a lot of blackfellas' families, because we take in these people who don't fit into their own society and their own culture, and they're looking for some kind of a spiritual connection, and they generally gravitate towards blackfellas, and blackfellas are, you know, we've got big hearts. We just go, oh, coin, yeah, poor little thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know,
we take everybody in. Yeah, we take everybody in. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they generally marry up to one of our mob, or, you know, they sort of drift on eventually. But, you know, yeah, so we get those little ones who want to sing and dance with us.
You made an interesting comment a minute ago regarding the organisations with their 12-month-only funding, no guaranteed future, no future planning and stuff because of this short time frame of funding. But the fact that they, and you said, the fact that they continue, that they still exist sort of thing, but more than exist, they even grow and develop. They flourish in a lot of cases. I mean, look at the First Nations Media Network. More than 100 communities from Torres Strait across to Perth and up in the Kimberley and wherever, there's 100 communities that have a broadcast facility, and a lot of them even have video production and stuff now. So not just staying in existence, but growing and flourishing as well is amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, Karma itself is a great example of that. It started off very small, and that's flourished into, you know, one of the, apart from Rachel Perkins' mob, Karma's, you know, grown into one of the biggest production houses in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's both in radio, or maybe not in radio, I can't speak on that behalf, but definitely in television and film.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, you have a look at Bush. You know, I think most of our radio stations started out as little pirate radio stations.
Yeah,
you know, we found a way to get on air, and well, not so much me, but the mob who came before me that definitely found a way to get our voices out there, and I'm incredibly grateful to them for that.
Well, that's what got me involved. My mother visited Alice Springs, and there was a forum there back in about 82. And came back all into, there was a forum about radio, you know, blackfellas in radio and doing programming. And she came back to Redfern all enthused about it. You know, that was my mother, Maureen Watson, who's a big name in film and acting and radio and storytelling and all sorts of things. So, yes, we grew from very humble and small beginnings, yes.
And that, you know, that's often the case, is one of our mob gets this, you know, this dream in their heart and a bee in their bonnet, and they just write, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to move mountains and swim seas to get to it, and they do. And you know, it's just, I don't know, I've got a lot of respect for those who came before me and open up so many channels. That's, you know, for young people like myself, well, I was young back then, I'm getting a bit grey now, but you know, that just, they gave so many opportunities, and the fact that you can, back then, I could listen to radio, I could hear my own languages on air, I could hear the music from my people, and it was such a lifting experience.
Mm-hmm. Your parents wouldn't have had that opportunity or that privilege of the luxury of hearing our own voices and language. I mean, the older generation. I mean, I'm 62 or so, and it's the first time I ever heard Blackfoot on the radio was Lionel Rose fight, you know, and he was fighting. He was the focus of it. That was a radio thing in 1965 or 66 or something. So it's big changes there.
Yeah, I think my mum, she speaks English as a third, fourth language. Mm. So a lot of my character Lola is based on her speech pattern when she's speaking English. And that's based on a lot of speech pattern of the mob here, where who speak English, you know, as a third or fourth language rather than the first one. And so you know, my mum didn't even get to go to the movies. She wasn't allowed to go to the movies. I sat down with her one day and said, "Oh, Mum, this is a film from your time. We'll watch it, hey?" And I said, "You've probably seen it before." And she's like, "No." Mm. I said, "What do you mean you haven't seen this film?" Because there was Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or something like that. Yeah. And she was like, "Oh, we wasn't allowed to go to the movies." Mm. And I was so heartbroken by that because I love movies. So I sat down with Mum and we must have watched every film from her era over 2 days. Sitting up all night and all day. I just wanted her to have that experience.
Wow, yeah. You're talking about speech patterns and you have used your mother's speech pattern as an English as a third language woman, speaker. Give us a line or a couple of lines that you use that can let our listeners know and hear what that speech pattern is that you talk about.
Well, Lola has a type of speech pattern who's like, "You know, I've been trying to tell them your mother, but you couldn't listen long me." You know, and people go, "Well, what language is that?" And you're going, "That's English." And they're going, "How is it English? What does it mean?" And I'm saying, "Well, if you listen closely, you'll hear.
Yes.
I tried to tell you all about it, but you didn't listen to me."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've let Lola run with that language. You know, a lot of we were getting told, people won't understand what you're saying. I said, yeah, people will understand what I'm saying, and people need to start understanding this type of language.
Yes, it's adaptation of English, the way we use the English language to suit us. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And just not just that, it's not our first language. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. And so they need to understand that some people actually can't get their tongue around English properly, or they turn it into their own, and people need to, they need to start negotiating and talking with Aboriginal people, and they need to come to the table having a bit of an ear for that type of language so that there's no translator having to translate English back to them.
Mm. Mm. Some people call it Aboriginal English. I don't know that it's a good term, but it's just it's a term.
Yes.
That describes
it. It is a term. Mm. Well, it's definitely at times a different language. When I was working at NITV, it was one of the really important things to me was that we get the mob from the bush, get their stories and get them to air. I don't know if that ever came through. I'm sure that there's stuff on NITV that, I don't know. I think it's very, very, there is a voice definitely for our mob in the city. We have all the radio stations, a lot of films and stuff are shot in the city and in the urban locations. But they're really, apart from, you know, the Remo network, there really isn't a lot of films being shot around our mob in the bush, which is a very, very different lifestyle to that in the city.
Mm-hmm. What do you put that down to?
I don't. I think it comes down to influence. You know, our mob in the bush we've been influenced too. It's all rounded up like cattle and chucked into certain areas and stuff, which is the same story around the whole country. I just think the mob in the city have had the influence of millions of non-Aboriginal people rather than, you know, a handful of mongrels.
Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've identified, or one of the issues, and it's a real bugbear for me, is the way that the dominant culture mob, they're probably the mercenaries that come along and get involved in radio and end up with a language name and even start to speak English. But their influence, they have far too much power and influence, especially through the Remos and some of the remote stations where these white fellas are in power, are in place, and blackfella would be lucky to get a job on a microphone, or they might be the admin assistant or something. But these mercenaries are in place, you know. Does that resonate with you? Do you see that? Have you experienced that?
Yeah, I have experienced that. ACMM touches on that as well in the series.
Right.
You know, we have this thing where, which I've always had a bee in my bonnet about, is that, you know, when Aboriginal organisations will take on, you know, we'll get money for traineeships or, you know, professional development, as it's called these days. But usually what will happen is that the person who's doing the training will sit in the main position, and then the little trainee comes in under the trainee wing. And so what happens is when the funding starts dwindling or going, you know, the first person you get rid of is the trainee. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this non-Aboriginal person sitting in the main seat who's not going anywhere. And I've always thought that was a very sort of wrong way of doing it. I've always thought you should put the trainee into the main position and have the training officer or the trainer in a mentor position, so that when the funding goes, you're not losing the Aboriginal person who's meant to be in that job. You're losing the one who's training them. And that, you know, the one who's sitting in the job nowadays, you know, you've got the internet and everything, you can learn very, very quickly how to do something.
Of course. Yeah, no, there's still today at every annual general meeting we have with our national media association, we still see far too many white fellas coming in from Top End, Central Way, and speaking on behalf of that mob out there. They're not bringing they don't bring the mob with them. They come in and they're the manager of this, or, you know, they run the remote broadcasting service. Not the little ribs. Generally, it's the what do they call them? The bigger organize. Well, yeah, the supportive role that these organisations have. RIMOs, the Remote Indigenous Media Organisations, that support the RIBs, formerly BRACs.
Yeah.
Far too many white fellas are still coming into the room after I've been involved over 30 years, and I'm still seeing these white fellas speaking for us, for our mob. They're not bringing them with them, you know, and it's...
I find that strange. I mean, I know that there are people out there who are genuine, you know. We get the 3Ms in our communities, but we also get normal people, you know. There's normal people.
If there's such a thing, but yes.
And then, you know, but I've always found that a strange thing, that after 20 odd, you know, radio's been going for, 30-odd years or something now. Mm-hmm. We've been broadcasting for. And I've always found that strange, that even now, where you should have the skills base in the Aboriginal community, and, you know, maybe we do, and we just don't have the opportunity to step up to those places. And I think it comes down to the boards of these organisations as well. For some reason, they're not employing our mob. And so while we can point the finger at some, you know, some of the missionaries and mercenaries who walk in the door and they're, you know, they're talking on behalf of our people, at the same time, we sort of have to look at the boards on our organisations and wonder why they're not trusting, in often cases, the very people they've trained themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that was always been one of my big hang-ups with some, you know, I won't name them, certain organisations in Central Australia and around Australia, is, you know, why won't you let me have this job? You've trained me. You know, so are you saying that your training is not good enough? And if that's the case, then you need to pick your game up and you need to start training our little mob to get to that point
where
they are the CEO or they are the general manager, you know. And that also, you know, our boards have to take some responsibility for the lack of Aboriginal people sitting in those high positions.
You're right. And I must clarify things too. It's not just the Top End and Central and places. On the East Coast, I've seen white fella station managers with a couple of black staff, and they get into a position and make decisions on the decision regarding self-determination, where we should be hearing black programming and black discussion and black politics and different things, as well as the entertainment and stuff. But the white fella sits up there and thinks, oh, no, that's a bit too offensive, or that's a bit harsh and on the ears, so we can't really do that. Whereas a black person, a First Nations person, would have a very different view, generally speaking, would have a different view on things. So I'm seeing it happen on the East Coast over here as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think the strongest karma ever was when Frieda Glenor was sitting in the top seat, or, you know, or Cilla Collins, just, you know, who's recently gone up to the top
seat. Nadja and Darwin. Nadja, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, at that time, sorry, got a little
cold right.
in my throat. At that time, I think karma was in its full swing. Mm-hmm. And that's when you have an Aboriginal leader sitting in those positions who knows which, in what direction they're taking their company. You know, you can only expect the best coming from it, because they're not second-guessing themselves, and they're not having to worry about, you know, whether they're stepping on, you know, cultural feet and stuff, because they generally have that knowledge in their head. And then, I find it a strange thing that in this day when we have the skills that we have, you know, amongst our young people who are now, you know, we've got a lot of our kids are going through university and they're finishing their qualifications and they're coming out. They're very smart little cookies we got now.
Yes.
And I don't understand why our little smart cookies aren't sitting in the top seat.
Yes.
And like I said, that comes down to the boards, because they're the ones who are employing people.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of Aboriginal people do go for those positions. And I don't know whether it's a concern that this person might rise above them, or, you know, it's that old crabs in a bucket thing, I think.
Yes, no, I like the way you put the responsibility at the feet of the board. It's they do have the power to change things. That's why they're on the board. That's why boards are there.
Well, they're the ones who employ people.
That's
you
right.
Know? And, you know, you can't just have someone walk in from the street and say, hey, I'm the CEO, and plonk themselves there and they're the CEO.
That's right.
Got to come through the board.
Yes, that's right. Listen, let's take a short break and come back. I want to come back and talk to you about the importance of First Nations media, the fact that we have, we own our own facilities, that we are able to articulate our identity, our history, all of this. How important is that within the broader scheme of things in this country, in this society today? I want to talk about that when I come back. My guest is Tricia Morton-Thomas, talking to me, a First Nations woman, Alice Springs based, and a Central Australian woman. She's been in front of a camera, one of the lead roles in Radiance many years ago with Rachel Mazur and with Rachel Perkins directing it and stuff. So, Tricia's now a producer and a director and a writer. And we're talking about 8MMM. It's a television series, 6-part series on the ABC. Starts tomorrow night at 8:30. So we'll come back and talk to Tricia. My guest here is Trish Morton-Thomas. And we're talking about 8MMM, a fictional radio station in Alice Springs. And there's a 6-part series starting broadcast tomorrow night, 9:30 on ABC. There's a 6-part series on this. And Trisha's one of the writers, one of the actors, one of the producers. She's multi-talented, this woman. Welcome back to Let's Talk. Trisha, you were just telling me about a little fella you get some inspiration from. Happens to be my grandson.
Yeah, geez, what a man. You must be so proud. Honestly, that little fella, he just gives me so much inspiration. I wake up in the morning thinking, oh, it's going to be a horrible day, or, you know, got some kind of worry on my hand, and I get on Facebook and I see that little face and I see what he's been up to. And, you know, he goes through, you know, it can't be easy going through the operations he has, even, you know, I'm the strongest grown man. And this little fella comes through it and he just smiles. He is a superman and he is a little warrior. I love the little bloke. I'd love to meet him one day.
Ah, well, I'm sure you will. Don't worry. You're going to make sure you'll meet everyone in the country. This fella, the way he's going on at 4-year-old, 4 going on 10.
Yeah, they're all like that, aren't they? 4 going on to 10 and 10
oh,
going
yes,
on to 20.
They're all many years. Think they're a lot older than they really are. But that's good. It's good to see that self-confidence in our young ones, you know, because I walked around with my head down a lot for a long, long time, too ashamed to walk into a restaurant in Redfern in 1978, 79, 80. I'd send the missus in first because she was white-skinned black fella. I'd send her in first. So it's good to see the confidence of these young ones coming through, Tricia. I tell you, it's a great change.
Yeah, it is. I've got my girls. They're very good musicians. They're incredibly good musicians. Uh-huh. But they get real shame. Just look at if I knew how to play the guitar and sing like you, I'd be outside singing my dee-whiz off every day.
Strutting your stuff, yes.
No, they're shy and they hold back and. I'm sure they'll grow out of it when they get older. They don't have enough confidence now. That whole shame job thing still hangs over our mob.
Yes, no, I think a lot of them will come through that, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There's certainly some good growth in the arts field. I mean, radio, film, video, TV, and it's... A lot of it makes a lot of it is good and easier today to get your hands around because it's all the digital era certainly makes it easier for us. Do you find that in Alice Springs?
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier. I find the skills of a lot of young people who are using their phones to make films and stuff or to make little skits that they're sort of sharing via phone networks. I'll have my nephew come over and he'll show me, oh, look what these mob made at Yindamu. Oh, look what these mob made at Papunya. And they're really good stuff. The quality might not be the greatest, but the content is exceptionally good. And it's those ones that we need to get a hold on. And these days, because I had someone say to me, a journalist last week or the week before, say, it's amazing that these filmmakers have just popped out of nowhere. This incredibly talented group of people have just sort of popped up out of nowhere, and you're going, it's not been out of nowhere. It's been 20 years of extremely hard work by the people in, the Indigenous unit at Screen Australia, the Indigenous units at ABC and SBS.
That's right.
have been extremely instrumental in training people up. And it's been a long process, and it's only now starting to come into fruition. And, even now we're still sort of, being coupled up with non-Aboriginal production groups or houses and stuff where, we're being told, look, you don't have enough experience, you have to match up with these people. And oftentimes you'll find that you're clashing with the very people who are supposed to be creating a project with you. And it's because those people have not really had a lot of experience with Aboriginal people. They may maybe seen us on television or, seen us walking down the street, and they don't know a lot about who we are. And it becomes extremely frustrating to then have to work with people who don't have a lot of knowledge about us.
Mm. Yes, it must be frustrating. I mean, it is frustrating. I experience it myself. They tend to sort of downplay your years of involvement in a particular industry, and because you're a black fella, then you just sort of... Yes, but the importance of being in control of our own media. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's extremely important that we're allowed to have our own voice because, we'll find that we have to compromise a lot in order to take care of the wider community. This is one thing that when I was working at NITV, I'd have to constantly have this argument with the head of television who was and business affairs, who were saying, we have to cater to the wider audience. We have to cater to the wider audience. And I thought, look, the wider audience has Channel 7, Channel 9, Channel 10, ABC, SBS. They have all of those channels.
And they've been catered to for over 100 years.
Yeah, that's right. And I could never get my head around this wider audience until I got, it clicked one day. Oh, okay, you're talking about a whiter audience, not a wider audience. And then that to me, I was just like, no, I can't work like this and I don't want to work like that. There are a lot of voices for non-Indigenous people in this country. But for our mob, it's always a struggle even to get our voice heard. I've become more, I don't know whether I should take a break from Facebook or not because I'm becoming really upset and angry about the stuff that's going on around the country. But, it's like we've taken a step back by 100 years. I'm sure with some people in this country, they'd be happy to grab a gun and mow us all down.
Yeah,
if they could get away with it.
No question about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the way that Fred Hooper, that First Nations man, Murawari man down Brewarrina way, northwest New South Wales, the way he was treated on the weekend by trying to march. He's an ex-submarine. He was in the Submarine Corps. He served time with the Defence Force, and he wasn't allowed to march with his former mates, the people that he served time with.
Yeah, and you know that same officer who was giving him a hard time also gave one of the journalists from NITV an extremely hard time.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know it's the intimidation tactics and stuff, and that you're kind of looking at it, and I don't understand what this issue is with from white Australia to our mob. It's you know the government's built it up so much the government has made us the enemy of the Australian people.
That's right.
And they constantly use this tactic where it's like, okay, we're going to pass this bill in Parliament that's going to be extremely controversial, so we're going to point the finger at the blacks.
Yes. Yep.
And that'll distract everyone. And, you know, I keep saying to friends and stuff, we're not the enemy. We're actually probably Australia's greatest... What do they call it when you're just all for your country?
Patriot.
Australia's greatest patriot. We've been fighting for this country since day one, and we would never will stop fighting for it. And the thing is, if land's given back to Aboriginal people, it remains in Aboriginal hands.
Mm.
It remains in Australian hands, and it's there for the future of all of our children because we're taking care of it. Meanwhile, the government is selling off our land to to all these big multinational organisations.
Corporates, companies, yes.
That's right. Mm. And they have actual ownership of the land, and it's large chunks of land that we actually don't have a say over anymore because of the trade agreements and stuff. And I keep looking at people and going, you need to be going marching with us or standing with us to get rid of these companies.
That's right. They're
the ones who are taking over their country, and they're the ones who are going to be changing our laws so that we're no longer free to be Australian.
That's a good point you make. That when country is in the hands of First Nations people, generally it stays there, and we can continue our role as the caretakers of country and look after country as opposed to having the guts ripped out of it and owned by overseas interests, generally big corporates. Yeah. It's a good point
you
make.
When you look at Australia, there's a lot of Australia owned by international companies.
Oh, yes.
They're not in our hands anymore. At least when the land's given back to the blackfellas, it's still there for all Australians to enjoy.
That's right, for future generations, yes. Now, tell me, what are you working on? What's keeping you busy at the moment? You've got Triple M. Is that all shot? Those six series are shot now?
Yeah, it's all done and dusted, thank the Lord.
All right.
So that'll be going to air tomorrow night at 9:30 on the ABC. At the moment, there's a couple of projects in the pipeline. I'm getting a little bit of humbug from ABC and Screen Australia to go into a series two for ACCC, but I really want to see how it's received on air.
Right.
So far, we had a screening on Sunday night here in Alice Springs. About 500 people showed up.
Wow.
And we had it on the council lawns, and it was a great night. There was, a lot of laughter, which was, when you're writing a comedy, that's a good thing to hear.
Exactly.
Yesterday I'm walking around town, I got people coming up to me, who were at the screening, and I insisted that the screening be outside so that it... Because in a town like Alice, sometimes, you have our countrymen coming to, they want to go into a certain establishment and they're not allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and they could be, polished. They could be shining from head to toe and it's still, you're not dressed appropriately or something like that. There's always some excuse as to why a black fella's not allowed in. So it was very important to me that the screening be in a place where the entire community could come to and not be turned away. And so, we had a good mixture of people. We had non-Aboriginal people, we had Indians, we had African people from Alice Springs, we had, and all the mob was there, and it was a deadly night. I think I walked away from it maybe a little bit concerned because it was the first time I sat down and watched this show from the audience's perspective. I put myself in the audience's seat and looked at it through a different set of eyes. And I can see the influence of the non-Indigenous producers, or even, you know, the producers that I work with in Alice Springs. Rachel Clements, she's my business partner in Brindle Films, which is my film company. But she's one of those normal ones. She's, you know, very insistent that the creative control of any of the series that we make remains in Indigenous hands. Mm-hmm. And she'll fight tooth and nail for that. But so I could see in these episodes the bits which were compromised by having to sort of work with non-Indigenous people, and sometimes through the broadcast themselves, where they're saying, you know, well, what was extreme to me was not extreme to the ABC or to the other producers, where they're going, oh, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't happen. It's like, actually, it does.
Yeah.
And about 80 to 90% of 8MMM is actually taken from the lives of people, you know.
Real life experiences,
I sat around talking to hundreds of people before I went into writing the first three episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all of these stories come from people's lives. Sorry, I've got my kids walking in and out of the house,
right,
and they're banging doors.
Don't be sorry. That's all part of it. Yes.
Yeah. So these really did. They came from real people's lives, and they're real people's experiences in organisations, and not just organisations. In Alice Springs alone, you know, we're talking about, this is a town that, in all honesty, if the Aboriginal organisations closed down here, it would become a ghost town. I know a lot of people here don't like to, you know, believe that it runs on the Aboriginal dollar, but it very much does.
Yes.
You
plays
know,
a big
tourism
role in
does,
local economy. It plays, the black dollar plays a massive role in the local
economy.
It does economy.
Play
yes.
a massive role, and we're sort of sitting in this town where the Aboriginal dollar makes them... you know, it does make the town turn around.
Yes.
And people are not appreciative of that. And they often, you know, more often than not, you're like at the moment there's vigilante groups cruising around
yes.
Alice Springs who are, you know, wanting to keep our kids off the street. And then, you know, sometimes I think they're fair enough, because you have kids throwing, and not just kids, but adults throwing rocks and everything at people driving in their cars, and that's a very dangerous thing.
Mm, yes.
But there are ways of dealing with that other than a vigilante group.
That is correct. There are other ways of dealing with it, yes.
And then you also need to look at why those kids are doing that. You know, this is a very passive-aggressive, well, not a passive-aggressive, but it's definitely warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids, they're still resisting. You know, and you're going, 200 years later, people are still resisting you and resisting your authority. And so you need to look at another way to be able to talk to people, not, you know, not deal with them, but sit down and go, okay, how do we get through this together as a community?
Yes, that's what we've got to offer. We've got ancient knowledge that's continually passed down. Yes.
Yes.
Where about
even that in itself, I've just finished reading what's that book, Dark Emu by
what a book.
Bruce Pascoe. I was so angry after I read that book. I was like, you know, these mongrels, not only did they steal my land and my languages and stuff, but they've also stolen my history. You know, and they've stolen the entire country's history. And it makes me so angry that if I hear somebody say to me now, oh, yeah, Aboriginal people are hunter-gatherers, I just go, you know what? Don't ever say that in front of me. You might as well be swearing at me, you know, because okay, we're not hunter-gatherers. And while we're still labelled as hunter-gatherers, you know, people can still walk all over us. And we need to get rid of that term in regards to our people.
You're right there. Hunter-gatherers, nomads, all that sort of stuff. It's just, yes. But that book is amazing, and it should be in every school. It should be, compulsory reading within the education system, that book.
Yeah, well, yeah, I have a big issue with the education system. I left school when I was 13 because I had an argument with the teacher about Captain Cook discovering Australia. So I just went, you know what, I'm not going to stay here and listen to this nonsense anymore. And luckily I had parents who were, you know, my dad was white, but he was all for us learning our Indigenous culture. He was very, very big on that. Whereas my mother, who knew that, you know, the future sort of, who knew that to be able to survive in this world, you actually do have to have a good grasp of, you know, white culture and white learning system. And so she pushed me to go to school. My dad pushed me to go to ceremony. So I was in a very unique position there. But with our schooling system, what is this nonsense about, you know, Aboriginal studies and Australian history? Well, aren't they the same thing?
Yes, it leaves a lot to be desired with the education system. It's about news time. It's a good point you make about being two-way strong, being able to live in with your own mob and understand culture and stuff, but also to be able to live in those in that white world. So it's great that you've got that, and that's all we can hope for with our kids. I think is that they two-way strong. That's what we got to aim for.
Yeah, Trisha, I reckon.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us today. It's really good to have a chat with you, and let's hope that your next work that you do write, the second series of 8MMM, and I'll look forward to watching each of those six episodes. Thank you again, eh?
No worries. Thank you for having me.
You have a great day. Talk to you later.
Bye.
That's Trisha Morton-Thomas, 8MMM, ABC TV tomorrow night, 9:30. Make sure you're tuned into it. Black comedy, more black comedy. It's time to go. Have a good day.